Hello, it's Dan Lebatard. Thank you for supporting the things that we're doing at Lebatard and Friends. We're going to be growing it out over the next year, a lot of different content in a lot of different places. And Lebatard and Friends is going to be about talking to our friends. And my relationship with Stan Van Gundy goes back a long way. It began really with him calling to just rip the holy shit out of me because of a column that I'd written. And he didn't like the fact that I was saying in print, as he was knocked out of Heat Management, I was saying in print that Stan Van Gundy himself would tell you that Pat Riley was a better coach than he was. And so I got the phone call of quit writing that. Don't write that anymore. Stop writing that. And so since then, I took that beating and I listened to him, and we've become friends over the years. And he's a person that I admire, who has been made miserable by coaching, by being an executive, and yet the addiction of it, he keeps returning to it, even though he's happier when he's not a part of it. So Stan Van Gundy is interesting, and he was honest about his time in Detroit. But before we get to that, Mike Ryan, tell the people about our presenting sponsors, please.
Oh, ZipRecruiter is presenting this week's South Beach session, and we all know how difficult hiring is. Hiring used to be hard, though. Now we've got ZipRecruiter.com/beach. Multiple job sites, they stack resumes, and it's a confusing review process. But today, hiring can be made easy, and you only have to go to one place to get it done. That's right, ZipRecruiter.com/beach. As applications come in, ZipRecruiter analyzes each one and spotlights the top candidates so you never have to miss a great match. ZipRecruiter is so effective that 4 out of 5 employees who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate through the site within the first day. Our listeners can go try ZipRecruiter right now for free by visiting the exclusive web address, ZipRecruiter.com/beach. ZipRecruiter, it's the smartest way to hire. Now, ZipRecruiter, they're sponsoring South Beach Sessions, but we have a presenting sponsor for our Lebatard and Friends Network, Dan, and that is Tissot, the official watch of the NBA. And each one of Tissot's timepieces delivers quality performance with traditional luxury. The Tissot Chrono XL is a great watch for those looking for a sporty chronograph with Swiss technology at an unbelievable price. Shop Tissot at us.tissotshop.com and at select watch and jewelry stores nationwide.
So let's get to Stan Van Gundy here. He is, as I said, he's become a friend, and we need you to rate, subscribe, and review to support the stuff we're doing around here. Here is Stan Van Gundy. I love this dude, and I've loved him for a long time, but our relationship started in a funny place. I actually remember where I was. I was in a coffee shop in New York talking to Stan Van Gundy on the phone. And he was really mad about a column that I'd written, and he just told me. And from right then on, no lie, I don't know if you remember this, Dan, but my respect for you has only grown since then. But you, the fact that you called me and just lit me up out of nowhere, I think at the time, I don't think you were even working. I think you might have been an assistant coach. Do you remember any of this?
I do, vaguely. I mean, I remember the thing that I remember about it was same thing, is that I gained respect for you, because in my experience, at least up to that time, and a lot of my experience since then, is some of the most sensitive people in the world to criticism are journalists. They like doing criticizing and want to be immune from criticism, and that wasn't you at all. Like, you were fine engaging in that and listening to what I had to say, and I remember telling people immediately after that you were a lot different than anybody that I had dealt with.
But you too are a lot different than anyone I've dealt with, in that you have such a unrelenting zeal about truth, about being honest, that you can't get out of your own way in terms of fines or saying things that you shouldn't be saying. Well, seriously, and it's something you've never been able to conquer, and it's something you and I have talked about for the better part of 10 years, as you've been fined how much money over the years because you can't keep your mouth shut on stuff.
Well, I'll tell you what, I've certainly been fined enough money that I could have paid at least a couple of my kids' tuition through college.
So why wouldn't you just shut up, Stan? Like, why, you know what I mean? Like, wouldn't it have been easier?
No, that's something that a lot of people that are around me, you know, just can't get over. And I don't really know. Like, there have been a lot of times in my life, and I've even said it to you at times, that no, I'm just not going to talk. I can do that. I can just avoid all interviews, you know, especially when I'm not coaching. Just, no, I'm not going to do anything. But when I'm on and faced with a question, I'll occasionally no comment and stuff, but I have a hard time doing that. As you know, I mean, I get a question and my first instinct is I'm just going to answer it and answer it the best way I know how. Now, I'm more guarded with team type information. Like, I'm not going to be critical very often with the media, with my players. I'm not going to say a lot of things that would make somebody look bad that I've coached or worked with. But as far as opinions on issues and things like that, and in sport and outside of sport, I've just never been very good at letting questions go.
Well, in the spirit of talking about some of the stuff that happened with you in Detroit, I'd like to examine some of it, because the people who care about you, I'm pretty comfortable saying this, and I count myself among them, don't think that coaching is very good for you, that the responsibility of that for your mental health, your physical health, all of it seems deeply unhealthy. So before I get into the specifics of what happened with the Pistons, am I saying anything that you would like to object to there?
No, it'd be certainly, you know, my wife, that's her concern. I mean, is, you know, she just talks about it in terms of my happiness, that, you know, I always say that I want to coach, but I'm never happy when I'm coaching, which also makes it tough on the people around me. I think my brother would agree with you on that. Yeah, I think most people would, and it's, I'm actually, one of the things that really bothers me is that I've been at this so long in a job that is a great job and have not really found a way to enjoy it as much as I should. I enjoy it more than the people around me think I do, but not as much as I should.
But can you explain it to me, Stan? Because you're a well-rounded individual. You're someone who has a lot of interests. And furthermore, you're someone who's very vocal about what I do for a living doesn't have any real worth. It's just entertainment and silliness. So within the context of that, I don't understand why there would be a heroin addiction with something that's just a total misery all the time.
You know, I mean, addiction is definitely what it is in a lot of ways. You know, it's really, for me, it's just the one thing that I've ever been able to feel really competent doing, or at least have the best chance at competence. And, you know, it's an overriding feeling at times within that season that I'm just not doing it well enough, that there's something else that I should be doing that would help our team a little bit more, and it eats at me, and I don't enjoy it. I can reflect on every mistake I make in a game, every mistake I make with a team, and it wears on me, and I have not done a good job of being able to simply do what I know what I should do. I should look at, you know, after a game, after a practice, whatever, you know, what went well, what didn't go well, and let's move on. What do we need to do moving on? And that would be better for me. It would be better for my team. It would be better for my family. It would be better for everyone around me. And it would certainly be better for me. But I haven't done a good job of that. And I'm well aware of it.
And so how does something like that get fixed? Because I've got a hypothesis about that, that control freaks, that coaches tend to be control freaks, but they don't actually, once things start, have all that much control. You got your timeouts, but you're dependent on players executing what you think. Would you buy my theory on that, that control freaks gravitate toward this stuff, and when they get this close to it, they don't actually have that much control?
Well, I don't look at it that way. It's one of the things that makes it really difficult to me, is I tend to take very personally what's going on out on the court. And so when we're not playing well, it's that I haven't taught well enough, coached well enough, drilled it well enough. It's a reflection on my ability and my performance as a coach, that those guys aren't performing as well as they should. And it's not even really results oriented, because there's plenty of times that I've come out of wins not happy or not been happy within a game. And there have been times, maybe not as many, where we don't end up winning, but where I thought that a team has played well and we've done what we wanted to do. So, but I take it personally, the way the individual players perform, the way the team performs, you know, that's a reflection on the job I've done.
What's the happiest you've ever been coaching?
Well, I would go all the way back. My first job as a head coach was at a small college in Vermont, Castleton State College, 1983 was my first year there as a head coach. I was there for 3 years. And, you know, the one thing at that level is guys are playing simply for the love of the game. I had really good players and we won a lot. That certainly makes it a lot more fun. I wasn't much older than the players. I got the head coaching job at 24, and I just had a lot of fun at that level. You know, it was purely about the game itself and trying to get better, and it was my first chance as a head coach, so it was exciting and fun, and that's the most fun I've ever had. In the NBA, I mean, I have had fun. I mean, my first year as a head coach in Miami was a great deal of fun. A team that started poorly and, you know, struggled, was 11 games under 500 with 20 games or 21 games to go, and then won 17 out of 21 and got to the second round of the playoffs. That was a lot of fun. My time in Orlando, you know, the problem is it's still not as much fun as it should be, because there's going to be losses in there. And the losses tear me up more than the wins excite me. But there's been a lot of fun along the way, too. It hasn't stuck with me for as long as the miserable times have, and the bad times in my own mind and in what people around me perceive have overshadowed the good times, and they really shouldn't have.
I'm curious here, because I don't know how much to reveal here. I don't want to make you uncomfortable, but I know that you suffered the ending in Detroit, the feeling of failure in a way that, you know, was restless or made you sleepless. So I don't want to betray any confidences, but can you sort of explain to us how you beat yourself up over that?
Well, it was really hard. I'll tell you what really got to me here. There were two things. Number one, it was upsetting to me, because I think we were getting close and we had made the deal for Blake Griffin. And then when we got him in there and then Reggie Jackson came back, we really thought with that group that we had a chance to be good. And then, you know, we didn't get a chance to finish it out. Blake got hurt. Those guys only played, I think, four games together. And so it was a feeling of, we didn't get this done. We didn't get the corner turned, but we're close. But then the thing that really gave me the sleepless nights and everything was that I had both jobs here in Detroit, which meant that I had a lot of people working for me. And the thing that people, I don't think fans really don't think about a lot when they're calling for coaches' heads and want the coach fired and everything else, is with the head coach, that's fine. And we're all vastly overpaid, and so we're in good financial situation if we get fired. But I think what people don't think about is, you know, I had 50 people working for me, and the vast majority of them in these kind of situations will end up out of a job, and they're not making huge money and things like that. They're worrying about how they're going to, you know, feed their family and where the next job is coming from and everything else. And for me, I felt a great sense of responsibility that had I done a better job, had we won more games, had we gotten into the playoffs, these people wouldn't be in the difficult situations that they were in. And I liked and respected all the people that I worked with, and I knew they didn't deserve to be in the situations they were in. And I felt like I was the one responsible for making their lives difficult. And if I could have squeezed out another 4 or 5 wins in either of the last 2 years, none of us would have been in that situation.
I'm curious, I don't know you to be an emotional man in terms of getting sentimental or romantic, breaking down in tears, but when you're talking to these people about the responsibility of that and feeling like the failure in it, I got to imagine that you get emotional during that.
Yeah, it was tough for me the night that I talked to my owner on the phone, a Sunday night, and you know, when the final decision was made, he was kind enough to let me be the one to break it to the staff, and I wanted it to be done in such a way that, you know, they heard it from me before it hit the ticker, and as you know, that's a hard thing to do. Like, if you can beat Woj to a story. it's difficult, but we were able to do that. And so the people that were in town, I was able to get them together as a group and tell them. And then everybody else, including the players, I had a chance to email and text very quickly before any word got out. And so obviously email and texts are okay, but then in front of that group in our meeting room and telling them was hard for me. I made it pretty quick so that I wouldn't break down and lose it, but it was a difficult time for me. Because even now I have difficulty. I mean, most of the people either were retained or have found other jobs. A few have not, and I feel great responsibility for that, and you know, feel like I let those people down. And that's the first time I've really gone through that. I didn't, obviously, the other time in Orlando when I got fired, I was just coaching, didn't have as many people under me, and it was easier to get everybody lined up with jobs. And so I didn't really have that immense feeling of responsibility that I had here in May when this one happened.
Let's talk about other stuff here. How much has been covered in your public life that really gets at what happened with you and Pat Riley in Miami? Now, the reason I bring this up is just because I remember at the time I didn't have enough information. And one of the mistakes that I made is that I was reporting on this as an authority, and I was basically saying that nobody was telling the truth, that you were being pushed out by Pat Riley. I didn't have all the information that I now have. What have you spoken about there that you're comfortable speaking about now without getting into any intimacies that you don't want to talk about?
Well, there really aren't any intimacies to talk about. And what I said at the time and what Pat said at the time was all true. And there just weren't many people who believed it, almost none in the media, none that I can remember, and very few fans or anything, and even some people close to me. And it was infuriating to me, as you know. I mean, because I think the one thing that I have tried to cultivate and tried to do throughout my career, as you said earlier, is to be honest with people. And yet, even when you have a track record of being honest with people, in that instance, nobody would listen to me and give me the benefit of the doubt that I was speaking honestly. I did not get pushed out. I was not happy for a lot of different reasons, and I just felt like it was time to step away and let Pat take over. And as I said at the time, we had been on a West Coast trip not long before the date when I stepped down. Pat had known my feelings since the very beginning of that season. And when we were out in L.A., Pat was out there in Malibu, and we got together out there. And, you know, he tried to talk me out of making the move to step down. But, you know, when he found out that, you know, I was or came to the conclusion that I was serious about it, then we were able to negotiate how we were going to handle it and what we were going to do. And in that instance, I was a little naive because I just assumed people would believe what we had to say, and no one did. And
well, what do you make of that? What do you make of that? Okay, so for those of you who don't know the story, some of the backstory is that Stan Van Gundy had Shaquille O'Neal and Dwayne Wade. He had them. That was a championship contender, legitimate by any means, and then he left the job, and for a variety of different reasons, family reasons and unhappiness, what he was talking about, unhappiness, and all of us thought that Shaq had overthrown you. All of us thought that Shaquille O'Neal was unhappy being coached by you, wanted to be coached by Riley, and so you would understand that part of the cynicism, though, right? The part that I would think is infuriating and frustrating is, as you said, the idea that you've always been honest with us, and here it wasn't buying you anything.
Yeah, and the decision, it was funny to me because, well, it wasn't funny. It was actually disappointing to me. First of all, it wasn't fair to Shaq. Whether Shaq was happy with me coaching him or not, I knew for a fact that Shaq didn't overthrow me because it was my decision to leave. This didn't come from Pat and me being pushed out the door and then people, that's where it started, is people assumed that Pat had made the decision, or Pat and Nikki had made the decision, and then from there, why did they make that decision? And it was because of Shaq, when the premise was wrong to begin with. Pat and Mickey didn't push me out. It was my decision to go. And I think people have a hard time believing that because, you know, I was in my third season as a head coach, had a really good team there.
Because it is hard. Think, because, Stan, it is hard to believe. Like, I'm not an unreasonable human being. Like, it is hard to believe. Here, we've just been talking to you about what a misery you are coaching. Here, you have a legitimate championship contender, and then you're like, I got to go. And it is hard to believe.
I get that part. I get that. But again, I mean, I just, and I was naive. I thought people, when I would sit down and tell them it was my decision, particularly the media in Miami, who I dealt with on a daily basis for the 2 years before, and in some capacity for the 8 years before that, that I thought that, you know, they would believe what I had to say. But that wasn't the case.
Stan, those are some frustrating handcuffs you put yourself in there, though, because you're sitting here, you're giving people only so much honesty, right? You're giving them your truth and your facts, but you're leaving out the reasons that you were unhappy. And when you leave out the reasons that you're unhappy, it allows the media to fill in the blanks with whatever cynicism they have.
Yeah, look, I get that. But at the same time, just what I'm saying to you now in Detroit, I mean, it's one thing to be honest, but being honest and, you know, throwing people under the bus or blaming other people for your unhappiness, that is just not something that I wanted to do. That's not the way that I wanted to go out in that situation. But, you know a little bit of it because you were there in Miami and you remember sort of how that summer was when, after we had lost in the conference finals in game 7 the year before, and then sort of what that summer was like after that and what was going on in the media and polls in the Miami Herald on who should coach the Heat next year, me or Pat.
Was that Greg Cody? Greg Cody who was putting those polls in the Miami Herald?
You know what? I don't know who was putting those in there, but guys were writing columns about it and things like that. And there just wasn't a lot of clarity, even within our organization, as to what was going to happen over the course of the summer. And so there was all those things going on and things inside and outside of the organization and everything else. But no one came close to pushing me out of the organization. I just sort of looked around. I wasn't real happy. And you know, you're looking around at a really good team and guys I like, loved my coaching staff, all of those things. And, you know, I still wasn't happy. You know, if you've got all those things going well and you're not happy and don't want to do it, I mean, that tells you something. And that's what happened. But to get into the real specifics of it would require me to, you know, be pointing the finger at other people. And that's not something that I wanted to do then, and it's not something that I want to do now.
What was your level of happiness in Orlando? Because that team was really good, too. That team was sitting there fighting with LeBron James. That's as good a team as you've ever been around.
Even when I was in it, but especially as I look back, I mean, that was an outstanding team of great people to be around, too. I mean, that group, I've liked virtually everybody I've coached, but that Orlando group was special in terms of the way they fit together as a group. I mean, the roster really fit, and it was a predominantly a very unselfish group of people, and they were willing to work, and they were willing to, you know, put up with my bad stuff to get to the stuff where I could help them a little bit. It was good. It was an enjoyable time. I have a lot of respect for those guys, but still, you know, when I say that, people go, well, you didn't look like you were enjoying it. And it's tough in the moment because I don't care. Everywhere I've been has been the same. All you care about is winning the next game. And if you win, you're happy for about an hour after the game, and then you're on to the next game. And in my mind, I just see nothing but pitfalls in the next game. You know, I see all these obstacles that need to be overcome before we go out on the court again. And so, yeah, I'm stressed out about that and always looking for what could beat us, and so probably didn't enjoy it as much. But overall, I really enjoyed that group of people that I had there. Still in touch with some of them, and have great respect for virtually all of them.
What's the bad stuff that you're talking about there that the Orlando Magic had to put up with from Stan Van Gundy?
Well, again, because I think that at times, you know, I can be over the top in expecting perfection, and I can wear people out with that. I do think I got better in my time in Orlando as time went on, but still probably too much, and probably didn't give guys enough of a rope at times, you know, and that can be hard. But again, I think that it was a mature group of people. I think you judge, you hope as mature people that you judge people in the whole. And while there were things about me I'm sure they didn't like, I think overall most of those guys would play for me again in a heartbeat. I think they enjoyed it. I think they know I cared about them. I think they know I respected them and liked them, and they wish I wouldn't have yelled at them as much, you know.
Yeah, that's but, it. That's really the core of it, right? That's the core.
Yeah. Yeah, but again, I mean, I think if you ask them, I'm confident that those guys, there was more they liked, a lot more they liked than what they didn't like. And I think that they respected the job that we did as a coaching staff in preparing them and getting them ready to play and giving them a chance to win. And I think in the long run, that's what good players in the NBA care about. Like, they do care about what kind of person you are, no question about it. But they're trying to win, and they're trying to succeed in their career, and they want somebody that can help them. And I think most of the guys that I've coached would say that I have, and certainly that group in Orlando. I think we had a lot of mutual respect there into what was going on. And look, it's the same the other way. I didn't like everything about every guy I coached, but overall I had great, great respect for them. And I think we cultivated a very good atmosphere there. Those of us that were there for most of the time or all of the time in the 5 years look back on it as a great time in our careers and one that we'll cherish.
When did you know that Wade was special? Was there a moment where you knew that Dwayne Wade, because you got the early years, where you knew, what we've got on our hands here is going to be one of the best guards of all time?
It started really early. I think for, you know, I don't want to speak for Spo or those other guys, but I think it really started for us in right in summer league. I mean, here was a guy that had not played at the point guard position at all in college. I mean, you know, he played off the ball, and we were looking ahead at our team, and, you know, Eddie Jones still on our team coming in, and we wanted to know if Dwayne could play at the point. And so we went into summer league and decided to play him there. And I was still coaching the summer league team because at that time, Pat, as you remember, stepped down after our last exhibition game of Dwayne's rookie year. So I was still an assistant. We coached him in summer league, and to watch what he did in summer league. Now, understand it's just summer league competition, but he's playing basically out of position and played tremendously. And we knew right then his intelligence was special. You already knew about the ability he had. And within 2 weeks of summer league, you realized that this guy had something special in terms of his intelligence and ability to figure things out on the floor. So you knew that that would bode well. And then when we got into training camp, and Spo was the one working with Dwayne on an individual basis, as he did for his first, at least the time I was there, for his first couple of years in the league, and you would watch them work on something, and then, boom, he could go out in the game and put it into practice right then, that day. I mean, most guys need months, even years of repetition before you see it on the floor. And Dwayne literally could do 20, 30 minutes and you'd see it on the court. And I mean, that's just special. And then you saw his ability to make big plays in big moments. The one that crystallized it for me was his very first playoff game We're tied in the final seconds, and we put the ball in his hands to make the right play. And not only does he score the basket, game winner in his first playoff game, but he just runs the clock down right to where it needs to go. And really gave that. They did have one chance on an out of bounds play, but I think he'd left 0.3 on the clock. They didn't really have much time. And Dwayne was the best that I've ever seen in those situations. There's nobody, that I've seen, that I would rather have the ball in those last second situations than him, and his ability to manage the clock and get a great shot.
No one. Michael, no LeBron, one no one.
No one better. No one better in those situations, my opinion. And I've had guys make big shots against me. I haven't seen anybody better in their ability to manage the clock and get quality shots up in those situations. And it started right there. Actually started in the summer league. We played Cleveland in the summer league, LeBron's rookie year, obviously, too. And Dwayne won that one in a summer league game on a game winner. And then his first playoff game, obviously I'm biased because I coached the guy, but I've coached a lot of other guys. And, you know, there's a handful of players who I would put ahead of Dwayne as players, but not in that situation.
I'm curious, why, given that, given the knowledge that you have, why does the country at large, if I suggest to the country at large of sports fans, hey, Dwayne Wade is every bit as good and was every bit as good as Kobe Bryant, there is no difference between those two players, would they laugh me out of a room?
Yeah, I don't know. There's differences, and you would acknowledge that too, in terms of the way they played the game. But in terms of who's better, yeah, it's really, really close in my opinion. Now, you know, they've both been great winners. They've both been able to score the ball. I think what happened is, you know, Dwayne had that great final series in 2006. I'm not really sure that anybody has carried a team to a championship in a final series more than Dwayne did in that one. There's some others that have certainly been in that ballpark, but I don't know anyone has had a better.
I don't think there has been, Stan. I don't think anybody has ever been better in a final.
Well, I agree with you, and he absolutely carried that team. And then they had a couple of years where they weren't quite as good. And then Dwayne in 2006 was sort of at the height of his notoriety. But then what happened with the LeBron and Bosh coming to Miami, I think hurt Dwayne in terms of the credit he's been given, because they went to four straight finals and won two of them. LeBron, and rightly so, got, you know, a great deal of the credit, more of the credit than anyone. And Dwayne was seen as Scottie Pippen rather than Michael Jordan. And I think it said a lot about Dwayne myself, because Dwayne really worked to bring that all together with Bosh and LeBron. And I think a lot of guys, even though they go to play together, they want to be the guys going in somewhere. Dwayne brought, that was his franchise. That was his city, his town. You know that. And he was willing to bring those guys in because he wanted to win. And while I think it did help him win, I think his level of personal recognition actually declined because of that. And he really hasn't gotten, he'll be a first ballot Hall of Famer, but he still hasn't gotten the acclaim that he deserves.
What is the worst loss of Stan's career? The one that was the night you couldn't sleep more than you couldn't sleep any of the other nights?
I'll tell you what, it was in a series we ended up winning against Cleveland in the series in the conference finals. So we had both games, we opened in Cleveland, and so we had to come from way behind early in the game to win it in game one. And then in game two, we have a chance to take a 2-0 lead on the road, and LeBron hits the shot that they still show every year when they're getting ready for the playoffs. Drives me crazy.
It was a bad shot. Stan, it was a bad shot. He made it, but it's not the shot that you want. I mean, you don't mind him taking that shot there, Stan.
should have been a second guy on him, though. And it drives me crazy because I didn't play it right defensively. And that could have cost us. It didn't end up costing us. We won the series in six games, but it could have. I mean, and that goes back to you talking about the misery of coaching for me, because we won that series in six games to go to the NBA Finals. And my overriding memory from that series is that I screwed that up at the end of game two and got beat and didn't have a second defender on him. I mean, if you ask me my main memory of that series, that's it.
Does anybody in the Van Gundy family have a sense of humor about your brother ending up on the ankle of Alonzo Mourning? Can I find a Van Gundy anywhere roaming the earth on this continent or another one that would find the humor in your brother Jeff, that photograph that I love, that if I were Jeff, I would have it in my house, but I understand why it might be a source of family shame.
I don't think it's a source of shame. I don't think anybody feels ashamed of it, including Jeff, but it's certainly not something that, we see the humor in.
So no. The answer is no. The answer is simply there's no.
Well, there aren't many Van Gundys running around, and so.
But the ones that are here, the ones we know about, don't find anything about what I'm doing right now funny.
Well, I know this. My parents, myself, and my brother do not. But maybe in 15 years or so, we'll sit down and watch that and we'll be able to laugh about it. I don't know. It's just, it's been something that we've never, those whole series, those Miami-New York series were not as great as the rivalries were and the competition and all of that during the time. It's certainly not one that was fun for me. And I don't think even for Jeff in a lot of ways, though he kept coming out on top, so it was a little bit more fun for him. But it's just not something we've never really gone back and talked about those series. Like, we talk about them in generalities about the intensity and the competitiveness of those series and the players involved and the great respect that Jeff and I had for players on both sides of it. But in terms of the games themselves, it's something we've never even gone back and talked about.
Pat Riley tells the story after one of those losses against the Knicks of Alonzo Mourning coming into his locker room, still in uniform. The team is just broken outside because they've lost again to the Knicks, and telling him while he's sobbing at his desk, that Pat's sobbing at his desk, Alonzo goes in and tells him, go do your job. Go talk to your team.
Yeah, I mean, I remember that too. It was the last time we went through it. It was, it was the shot that after Clarence Weatherspoon missed the shot, I believe, and we were in Miami, and so it was in our own locker room, and we had lost at home, and it was a difficult time. But what was tough about all those is that we were the higher seeded team all the time, and it was close. I mean, those were great series, and it was a great rivalry, I think, for a lot of reasons, but a lot because the teams were so similar. Pat had coached that team in New York and then came to Miami. And so if you look back on it and you compare it to today's game, I mean, it was just ugly basketball in a lot of ways. I mean, it was literally, you talk about grinded out games. I mean, teams were just fighting. And one of the great things I remember as people have looked back on the series, and I don't know, it was quite a while ago now, but somebody had asked Dan Marley about what he and Allen Houston had said to each other, because Dan always guarded Allen Houston in those series. And look, we're playing them at that time, a series plus four games a year, and you're playing them 9 to 11 games a year and the whole thing, and Dan never said one word to him in that entire time. And that's what it was. I mean, there wasn't a lot of talking. I mean, and there wasn't the congeniality that there is a lot of times now between the teams and the hugging and kissing and all of that. I mean, that might have been, I don't know if it was the last time, but it was certainly one of them. I mean, those teams fought, and I think they look back on it. I've talked to some of those guys over the years. They look back with great respect for the guys on the other side. But at the time, I mean, it was intense.
Well, the stuff with Zoe and Larry Johnson was a bit scary. Like, those, I don't know what was happening with them, but, there was something bad happening between those two.
No, there's no question. I mean, look, those teams, I mean, it was – I haven't been around anything like that since then. I mean, there's rivalries and things like that, and there are some teams with bad blood. That there's that, but not with the level of intensity on the court. And in fairness, a lot of that is because the rules and the way the game's officiated has evolved for the good. For the good. I mean, a lot of us didn't like it at the time, but you look back at those games now, and you're like, "Why did we let people play like that?"
Is it true that you guys were fining people if they helped the opponent up?
It was in our book, you know, your team guidelines that you gave the team. It was in there. In reality, I don't remember anybody ever getting fined, but I also don't remember anybody ever picking anybody up from the other team. So it's probably why they didn't get fined. I mean, it was a different world. The NBA was different at that time. It was different in the way the game was officiated. The rules were different, and the atmosphere was different around games at that time. And I don't really know anybody who would dispute that. And it doesn't mean that the guys then are necessarily more competitive than the guys now, but there just wasn't the level of collegiality at that time that there is now. And there's certainly, because of the rules, wasn't the level, there's not the level of physicality now. I mean, now where you see the greater physicality actually is in the WNBA. I don't know why. They go by the same rule book, but they let those women absolutely kill each other. But our guys, the game's just not that physical a game anymore.
Is it fair to say that those series were so hostile and the stuff with your brother was so uncomfortable for you to be on the other side that there was damage done to the relationships involved with Pat Riley and you and Jeff, or is that not a fair thing to say?
It didn't affect my relationship with my brother at all, other than we never talked during the series, ever. Once it was time to start the series till it ended, we never talked, and we generally talk almost every day. But in those series, we didn't talk. And so you had a couple of weeks. It didn't affect my relationship with Pat at all. Pat knew where I stood. I mean, you know, I don't think that was ever a question. It definitely affected Pat and Jeff's relationship. But I've seen that many, many, many times in the NBA. I mean, it's tough to go out and compete against people and be friends with them. You can do it regular season matchups, but if you have a couple of playoff matchups, it's unfortunate maybe, but it's going to happen. I mean, there's just going to be a different level of intensity and animosity, I guess.
So at the height of these crazy rivalries, physical and all that stuff with your brother hanging on Zoe's ankle, like these series are just totally crazy. And at the end of one of them, Pat decides to raise the stakes. He calls me from his boat or something, and I write a column in which Pat was really harsh on Jeff, publicly harsh on Jeff in a way we hadn't heard, escalating the stakes on all of that. Do you remember reading those words, where you were and how you felt about that? Because that puts you in a really awkward predicament.
I do remember it. It didn't surprise me. I certainly knew who Pat was. You know, I thought it was disappointing, but it happens a lot in that two guys who had so much in common and a guy like Pat who had been such a mentor to Jeff, you know, to see that relationship really go away. I mean, I don't think they really even have a relationship or never did after that. I thought it was disappointing, but I didn't find it very surprising. And again, I never had a problem with Pat. I don't think Pat ever had a problem with me in regard to that series. I mean, it was uncomfortable for me at times, you know, to read those things, but he never made it uncomfortable to, you know, to come in and go to work. And I don't think he ever questioned where my loyalties lied in terms of who I wanted to win. And at the same time, he knew that I was always going to, you know, on a personal level, my loyalties were going to lie with Jeff. So he was able to handle all of that. I think everybody understood what was going on.
Tell us about what happened with Dwight Howard. You guys had the publicly famous, I mean, that, can you laugh at that now, or you're not going to laugh at that either? Because I thought that was one of the gangster press conferences of all time, where you're, you know, sipping diet soda and you're being publicly harsh on Dwight, and he comes over and puts his arm around you and starts smiling as you're ripping him. Can we see the humor in that now that you've repaired your relationship with Dwight, or we're not allowed to laugh about that either?
Okay, I can see why people think it was funny. Yeah, on one hand, I regret it, and on another, I don't. I regret it because of the pain that it caused Dwight. I mean, I just read something even this summer that it was the worst day of his career, you know, and I felt bad when I read that because the guy did a lot for me and our organization, and I feel bad that it was that bad for him. I wasn't trying to strike out against Dwight. I was upset with my organization at that point, and they let, in my mind, they had let a lot of BS remain out there locally in Orlando. But it was, I thought it was a distraction for our team, and what I wanted to do was just get rid of all the speculation and put it right to, you know, what the facts were, which was that I knew for a fact, because I had been told by highest level people in our organization that over the summer, Dwight had said that he wanted a new coach, and they decided not to do that. And I said, yeah, that's what happened. And it was just to hopefully try to, in my mind, put all the speculation to rest. But the fact that it caused that much consternation for Dwight, that does bother me. When I read that this summer, you know, I sort of shook my head and felt bad about it.
Well, why'd you do it at the time? Like, what?
Well, we had a lot of speculation, you know, just swirling around our team, and you know, I didn't like it. I mean, it was all the stuff. I mean, a lot of talk at that time about, you know, my relationship with Dwight. Does Dwight want to be here? Is Dwight going to leave? Did he want to get traded? Did he want to get traded because of the coaching situation? I mean, it was out there all the time, and I thought it was a great distraction to our team, and that we were having trouble focusing on what we needed to focus on basketball wise. And so my motivation was, I'm going to put the speculation to rest. You know, we don't need to speculate anymore. This is exactly what happened. So what? We're going to move forward. I mean, at the time I said, it happens all the time. There's guys not happy with their coach and they want somebody else, and we'll learn to deal with it and we'll move on. I just wanted to put the speculation to rest.
Bad timing, you know, though, with Dwight coming over at exactly that second.
Well, obviously. Well,
I know, but comedically, comedically, that's where it's good.
Oh, no, there's no question about that. And people were, you know, texting me and, you know, laughing about it. But it wasn't, you know, the timing was not ideal for sure. But again, what happened, and this shows you the level of what was going on, is people were, you know, speculating about this so-called rift between Dwight and I, which at the time, and until that press conference, we didn't have. And so one of the writers who'd been talking to Dwight separately, you know, told him what was sort of going on, the speculation. And so Dwight wanted to, I guess, a show of unity after I just sort of outed him a little bit. And I mean, give me the situation to do over again now, you know, 6 years later, and I wouldn't do it the same. But that's different from saying that, you know, I really regret that I did it. I thought that the organization sort of threw us all under the bus at that point, and I was trying to fix it, but didn't do it well.
I'm wondering, is that the biggest do-over that you'd like? Like, if I gave you a do-over, is that where you'd use it, or somewhere else professionally?
No, there's only one moment in my professional career that I truly regret and will haunt me, and that is in the process of taking the Orlando job. Originally, you know, Billy Donovan had taken the job, and then he went back to Florida, and then Orlando had offered me the job, and Pat had refused to let me go to Orlando. And I was talking to Sacramento at the time. They had offered me the job. I wanted to go to Orlando. Pat would release me to go to Sacramento, but not to Orlando. So I got on a plane and went to Sacramento with the idea my wife and I were going to go look at houses. And if everything was good with my wife, I would take the job while I was out there. So that was the deal. And I flew back on a private plane. We flew back on a private plane from Miami to Sacramento with Jeff Petrie and Wayne Cooper. They gave us a car and we were to go off. As soon as we landed out there, Orlando called and said, hey, look, don't do anything. We think we can get this all worked out. And so we didn't look at a house. I spent the rest of the day avoiding phone calls from Jeff Petrie, who I'm sure was hearing rumors, and eventually got the deal worked out with Orlando at like 6 o'clock in the evening Pacific time, took a red eye out and did the press conference in Orlando. And as someone who has really tried hard and prided myself in acting with integrity in my career, I showed no integrity toward Jeff Petrie and the Kings organization. On that day, I was simply doing what I thought was best for me, which was try to get the Orlando job, but keep Sacramento on the hook, and so avoid Jeff Petrie all day. And it was selfish, and it was not my finest moment, and I've regretted that ever since, and it bothers me every time I think about it.
Boy, I'm just mining all the stuff that bothers you, Stan. I'm just going over and over the stuff that hurts and the stuff that's dark. So let me do it again here. I really do feel like you could have had that Golden State job. I really do. I think that you were the coveted candidate at the time. And I understand your reasons for doing what you did. You liked Detroit ownership. It seemed like a partnership. They were going to give you control over the groceries and allow you to do the cooking. But man, oh man, Stan. You'd like a do-over there just because there would have been so much winning.
No, if I had that one, and I just got fired. And that has been a tremendous disappointment for me. But if I had it to do over again, even knowing what I know now, I would have done the exact same thing. So that one doesn't, as far as a decision, if I had had that, I mean, here's the other thing that's hard to weigh is I never had that decision to make. I could have stayed in the running for the Golden State job, but I didn't have a job offer from Golden State. And so it really made the decision somewhat easy.
I know, but I'm talking about a hypothetical. I'm talking about...
Even as a hypothetical, even if I was sitting there on that night with an offer from Golden State, even if that were the case, I would have still gone to Detroit. And if it's 4 years later, looking back, I still would have gone.
But how can you say that? Explain that to me. I'd like to understand it. How can you say that given what the results in both places were?
Well, because I wanted the challenge that I got in Detroit. I really wanted it. And, you know, even though it didn't end up working out, I wanted that challenge. I wanted to work for that ownership group in Detroit. And I wanted to be in control of who I could put in our offices there. So I would do it again. I mean, would it have been a great experience to coach such great players in Golden State and to work with a guy like Bob Myers? Yeah, I mean, but that's not what I was looking for per se at the time. I had, you know, obviously had advanced farther in the search with Detroit. I liked what I saw there. I was excited about the possibility, and I'm happy with the way it turned out.
You are really human. You are fundamentally decent. You really like the owner of the Pistons. So I'm curious, because you're a relationship builder, and I don't know many people who don't like Stan Van Gundy when they get to know him. How hard was that last conversation with your owner where you're breaking up?
Well, I can't comment from his side. From my side, it was hard because I was getting fired. I mean, you know, and here's the thing. Like, I don't have one bad word to say about Tom Gores. I think what you should expect or even go beyond expect, hope for, is that anybody you work for as an owner will support you while you're there and give you, you know, what you need to succeed. And Tom did that. And he's a good guy. I like him. So I've got nothing bad to say about him. But, look, I mean, I don't like the decision that he made. I, you know, I obviously didn't agree with it. I didn't like it. Certainly because of that, I mean, I don't expect that Tom and I will have a relationship going forward. I have no bitterness toward him whatsoever, but, you know, our relationship was based on working together toward a goal. And then once somebody tells you, no, I don't want you anymore, I mean, you're not going to have a relationship. I haven't talked to Tom since he fired me, and I don't expect that I probably will. But I like the guy. I respect him. It was his decision to make as an owner. He handled it the right way. He was upfront about everything. I mean, there's nothing more I could ask for. So, you know, I there's nothing I'm bitter about, but I don't anticipate that we'll have a relationship.
So how does that end up working out, though, like at the very end of that conversation or during that conversation? Are you arguing on behalf of your job at that point, or is the decision made and you know it's made, and so you're going to not say what you think on that front?
Yeah, no, that whole phone call, there was never an argument. I mean, Tom had come to his decision, and that was it. I mean, you know, we had had time. I mean, it took a long time now. I mean, we were, you know, we didn't make the playoffs, so you end in, I don't know, April 12th, 13th, whatever it was, and I didn't get fired till May, like the 6th or 7th, something like that. And so it had taken some time. So we'd had plenty of time to talk about the job situation and everything else, and I'd had a chance to advocate and the whole thing. I mean, there was a path. If we went all the way back to the end of the season, there was a path where I probably could have remained with the Pistons, but I don't think it would have been good for me or the organization. And so, you know, Tom made his decision, and I didn't agree with it. I, you know, was disappointed by it. I was bothered by it, but again, it was his right to make it. In comparison to, you know, a similar situation getting let go in Orlando, Tom certainly handled it 100% better and was more upfront, and I respect the way he handled the situation.
Our thanks to Stan Van Gundy. We will be back next week. But, Mike, tell the people about, if they want this, because we're building menu items around here, if they like this and they want this and they want something else from Levitard and Friends, what can they get?
We have Mina Kimes, an all-year football podcast. We have Sarah Spain. We have Marty Smith with great guests like Ric Flair joining the network. So if you support what we're doing, subscribe. We have a feed that is going to be up so you can subscribe to everything on there. And coming next week, a brand new original concept from Levitard and Friends.
Very cool. Talk to you next week.